This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Just last week, Gary Burton set up his vibraphone and performed a tiny desk concert at NPR in Washington. You can see a video of it at radioboston.org, and it's worth seeing. Burton is 70 years old now, but his flying four-mallet technique is still dazzling to watch and to hear.
Gary Burton has been playing the vibraphone for more than half a century, with some of the biggest names in jazz, Stan Getz, Chick Corea, Larry Correll. And he's known just about everyone else, from Duke Ellington to Miles Davis to John Coltrane.
Burton was a pioneer of jazz rock fusion. Over the course of his long career, he's been a mentor to younger players, including Pat Metheny. He also taught for more than 30 years and became a dean at the Berklee College of Music here in Boston, where he'll be performing tomorrow night with the new Gary Burton Quartet.
Here's a bit from the quartet's new CD called Guided Tour.
Along with his new CD, Gary Burton has just published a memoir. It's called Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. And what a remarkable journey it's been for this white kid from Indiana farm country. And Gary Burton joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Nice to be here.
It's really, really good to have you. I want to make sure your mic is on. I think you're with us now.
Okay. Oh, there I am.
There
yes.
You are. Okay. Oh, that's so much better. Gary Burton, there's so much I want to talk to you about. But tell us first something about the new Gary Burton Quartet, because, in fact, this is the third time you've called a quartet new, right?
Yes. Well, it seems like, you know, the last time I called my group the new Gary Burton Quartet was 1973. So
it's been a while, right?
It's been a while. Yeah. So I decided to kind of, and I hadn't had a set band for a while. So this was a few years ago when I decided to put a new group together. It seemed okay to call it that.
Sure.
And actually the concert tomorrow night is a little different. It's actually a quintet. I've brought back a pianist who played with me during the years of like 2004 to 2008 in my band at the time, Vadim Nezalovsky, a really talented young pianist from Ukraine originally, and he lives in New York now. So we're actually going to be a quintet tomorrow night.
All right. So tell us and then you've got Julian Lage,
a
young guitar player, right?
Yeah, Julian is like one of the really major stars among the new generation in jazz. 25 years old, absolutely fabulous player, and already making a name for himself with his own records, his own band, and so on. I feel lucky that we're still able to play together as well. I actually met him when he was 12 years old, saw him playing on a television show, and was so impressed that after a few days of thinking about it, I said, I really want to know who this kid is, and tracked down his name and that he lived in California, called him up, we got acquainted, and we started playing together, casual things now and then. And by the time he was 15, we made our first record together and onward from there.
That's amazing. So what did you hear? What was he doing when he was 12 that made you want to call him up?
Well, his playing, he had one short solo in this little TV spot, and he played for probably 20 seconds. And yet it was so well formed melodically. It was so mature, and he played so naturally that I said, well, for a kid to play that maturely, this is really unusual. And I'd like to see if he plays that way all the time or whether he just had a really lucky night on that one occasion. It turned out he was even better than I had guessed.
Wow. Well, this is a track from your new CD, Guided Tour, and this is a number called Helena, written by
Julian, yeah.
Yeah, let's just listen for just a few seconds here.
Thank you.
So that's the great vibes man, Gary Burton, and his the new Gary Burton Quartet. Their new CD is called Guided Tour. We mentioned, Gary Burton, that one of the hallmarks of your career has been that you've sort of brought up younger musicians, names like guitarist Pat Metheny. Now we're talking about Julian Laja. What does it mean for a musician like you to play with younger players?
Well, I get so much out of what they bring to it. There's something about young players, their enthusiasm, first of all, for the gig. When you've been doing it for decades, going to yet another gig becomes kind of routine.
Yeah.
But when you're new at this, every night is exciting. You can't wait to get back on the bandstand and try these songs again and see what's going to happen.
So that sort of rubs off on you?
And it does. It absolutely does. And they challenge you, too. They'll come up with ideas and things that you wouldn't have thought of and say, you know, can we try that? You know, what do you think of this? And they're constantly growing at a real fast pace. So it tends to inspire everybody around them.
Listeners, we're talking to Gary Burton. He's a multiple Grammy Award-winning vibes master. He has a new CD and a new memoir. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. What's your question for Gary Burton about the world of jazz? He's played with some of the great names. Give us a call. Join the conversation. You know, this idea, Gary Burton, of playing with younger player leads to a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about your career as a music educator. You taught at Berklee here in Boston for more than 30 years. You served as a dean. How did your years of teaching there shape you, change you as a musician?
Well, I started teaching around the time I turned 30. Mm. And I discovered that I had a knack for explaining things. Hmm. I had started getting invitations to do what we call clinics or workshops, where you go in and for a short afternoon or a couple of hours, you work with some students or give a presentation at a school or a music store or something. And I realized that I seemed to have a knack for this, and I also enjoyed it. Figuring out how I do something so that I can explain it to others is what's going on. So at a certain point, I thought, you know, I think I, you know, could see myself teaching along with my playing career. So naturally, the place to do it was Berklee, my old alma mater. Mm. And so I moved from New York back to Boston in 71 and started teaching. And it had a really healthy impact on my overall playing. I think one of the dangers you run as a player as you get older is you become isolated. Mm-hmm. And you're playing day after day with the same four or five people, and you're not exposed to a lot of alternative things. Whereas at school, there was a million things going on at all times, and students asking questions that made me stop and think about things, or new kinds of playing and new kinds of music that I hadn't seen before. It turned out to be a really healthy environment for an aging jazz musician, put it that way.
I like the idea that you have a knack for explaining things, and it sort of, I don't know, this may be unfair, but it doesn't seem typical of the sort of the typical idea we have of the sort of mysterious, aloof jazz veteran. I'm thinking of, you know, someone like Miles Davis. Mm-hmm. You're open, thoughtful, willing to talk about it, not cloak this music in mystery and sort of words that really can't explain what's going on.
Yeah, well, some musicians actually like that, you know, mystique thing.
Yeah.
They want to keep it mysterious. It's part of their personal shtick, let's say. But for a lot of musicians in the generations before mine, really didn't know how to explain things musically. They hadn't gone to school. Mm. My generation was the first generation that actually went to music college and got, you know, the kind of technical information, harmony and theory and composition and so on. The jazz musicians that came of age in the 30s and 40s and 50s were self-taught. And you asked them a technical question, and they were kind of at a loss for how to put it into words. And so it was easier it is to say, well, I just play what I feel or I just play what yeah. I hear. And
they meant it in that case.
And they did because yeah. they didn't know. I mean, I played with Stan Getz for 3 years when I was starting out, and he was a self-taught musician, and it was something that haunted him his whole career. He was terrified that any day now we were all going to turn to him and say, you know, who are you kidding? You're not a professional musician. You don't know what you're talking about. And
I'm so glad you brought up Stan Getz because you write so interestingly about a bunch of these guys you played with. And I wanted to ask you about him. And let's just listen to a little bit. This is you and Stan Getz performing a version of George Gershwin's classic Summertime off of the 1965 live album Getz O Go Go. So, Gary Byrne, some of the most interesting part of your book is what you write about Stan Getz. And your relationship with him got off to a pretty rocky start. And I'm wondering if you can tell the story about, you know, he was looking for either a pianist or a guitar player. Someone mentioned, hey, go to Gary Burton. He plays the vibraphone. He does it in a way that is full of chords and richness, and you could use him.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well,
didn't work out so well.
He'd never played with a vibraphone player before, and he did get a recommendation to try, the vibraphone. So he asked me to come down to a club and sit in with his then current group, which did have a guitar player, and I didn't know their songs or their arrangements. And the guitar player also played quite busily, so I couldn't really jump in there and do much. But the only time I could really play chords and accompany would be during the guitar solo. But when Stan soloed, the guitar player filled everything in, so there was nothing for me to do. And about the fourth or fifth tune, I just played behind the guitar solo, and then Stan started playing, and I stopped. And he turned to me with this red face and angry voice saying, "What's wrong with my soloing? Why do you only play for him?" And I then discovered what turned out to be a classic case of Stan's paranoia. And that shook me up so much I could hardly play the rest of the set. So I didn't get the job that night.
But, yeah, I understand that gig ended with them saying to you, "Don't call us, yeah, we'll call you."
Right. But then, a week or two later, I got the call to, come in, play with him after all, because they hadn't found anyone and they were desperate. So I sort of reluctantly said, okay, I'd have nothing else to do. It's a gig. I'll take it. It 3 weeks in Canada was the tour. Mm. So during that 3 weeks, things kind of gelled and came together. And by the end of that time, he said, well, come on, play some more gigs with us. And that ended up being a three-year stretch.
He could be difficult. He abused alcohol. You write that he could be sort of abusive. And then you also talk about this sort of paranoia he has because he wasn't this classically trained, but he didn't have deep education in music. But you learn to really love and respect the way he played.
Well, he was a very natural musician, mm-hmm. just a wonderful lyrical soloist. And on a good night, he was fabulous. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot from playing with him, from being around him. He had a lot of demons. In fact, today, this was back in 1964, 5, and 6. Today, he would have most likely been diagnosed as being bipolar. He swung back and forth between being almost giddily happy and positive to being, angry and paranoid and think everybody was out to steal from him and so on. And he was drinking heavily all the time during these years. That had replaced his heroin addiction, which dominated his, first decade of his career. He had a lot of baggage, but it was wonderful to play with him in spite of, the extra effort required.
Listeners, we're talking to Gary Burton. He's a Grammy-winning vibraphonist, of course. He's played with just about everyone over the years. He's got a new biography called Learning, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton, Learning to Listen. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. And Gary, we've got a couple of callers who'd love to get in on this conversation. Norm is calling from Waltham. Hi, okay. Norm, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call. And Thank you very much, Mr. Burton, for that great music all these years. It's
sure.
Been wonderful. Thank you. My question has to do with what you saw when you were at Berkeley. Specifically, how can you describe the difference between the students who want to go and become performers versus the students who want to go out and become actually musical educators themselves?
Well, when you're starting out as a student, let's say you finished high school and now you're starting to college, it's not real clear to most of us what path we are destined for. We know we like music and we want to be somewhere in music, and you find out within a year or two of mixing it up with the other students whether you're at the level that is likely to succeed or not. And so a lot of students decide after a year or two of thinking first they want to be a performer. They've realized, okay, this doesn't look like it's working out, but I've got other options here. There's a music business. There's music therapy. There's education. You can still stay in music and have a choice of other careers. I think 99% of the students that come to Berkeley have performance in mind when they first arrive. But that's one of the things that you learn at Berkeley or any good music school, is whether or not you personally are cut out to be one of those people who is a natural performer, or whether you have talents in other areas.
Hmm. Thanks so much, Norm, for that call. Gary Burton, one of the big themes that runs through your book is this question of who you are. And I want to talk about sort of where you began the book and where you ended the book. You famously came out publicly as gay 25 years ago in an interview with Terry Gross. And you have this great passage in the book toward the end where you say, 25 years ago, I told Terry Gross I was a jazz musician who happened to be gay. Later, I came to think of myself as a gay guy who happens to be a jazz musician. Perhaps it's most accurate to say I'm just a guy who happens to be gay and happens to be a jazz musician. So it sounds like you ended up in a nice place at the end of this book, at the end of this sort of personal meditation mm-hmm. on who you are.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
I guess we all kind of wrestle with our own identity, for a good portion of our lives as our careers evolve and our, experiences in life help shape us and so on. And certainly for me, a big turning point was when I finally figured out midlife that I was gay. And then, it was like starting a new life. And it took me a while to kind of figure out exactly what that means to me and how it was going to ultimately affect my career and my personal life. Mm. And here I am 70, and I just got married recently to my partner.
Just this summer, right?
This past summer.
Congratulations.
To my partner of almost 9 years now. And, it feels like I'm still evolving, to be honest.
It's so interesting to hear that. And I read this great quote from one of your longtime collaborators. This is bass player Steve Swallow, who said there was a kind of breathing out that he was able to do when the truth was told that worked to his music's advantage. Would you agree with that?
I guess so. That's a nice way of putting it. he can be a real poet in his way. And Steve was one of my closest collaborators. We played together for the most part, off and on, over 22 years, and he was there during a lot of the formative years of my own style emerging, my own career getting established, and so on. So I felt like he was an integral part. He was the guy I talked everything over with and whose advice I always sought at every new turn in the road. He was just incredibly valuable to me as a fellow musician.
Let's take another call. We're talking to Gary Burton, the great vibraphonist. Let's go to Jeremy, who's calling from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question, I'm a rock drummer, and I play some melodic percussion. And my first exposure to the vibraphone and other melodic percussion was through rock music. Hmm. I was just wondering, and over your long career, I mean, since then I've gotten to know jazz vibraphones and jazz melodic percussion, including yourself, quite well. But I'm wondering if over your career, what your reaction has been, if you've kept an eye on kind of the increasing frequency of the use of vibraphones and other melodic percussion in the rock repertoire, thinking of bands like Tortoise or Calexico. Have you thoughts about that?
Well, you just mentioned two that I've never heard of. So I think I need to get busy and get on the internet and check this out. There used to be a rock band called the Sons of Champlin. Back in the 60s that had a vibraphone player. But for the most part, I haven't seen vibraphone in too many bands. Frank Zappa had mallet instruments in the Mothers of Invention, a husband and wife team, in fact. And I'm sure they're here occasionally. In fact, I've even been, you know, hired to come in and play on the occasional pop or rock record myself. I just did a track on Timothy Schmidt's most recent solo effort, came out last year, and I did a record with Eric Clapton once about 10 years ago, and Howard, was it Howard Jones? Yeah, I think was the name, another British rock singer. So there's, you know, there's a bit of vibraphone sneaking in here or there. I think the reason you don't see more vibraphones in rock music, there's probably two reasons that come to mind. One, it's not a loud instrument. So in a live situation on stage, it's kind of hard to hear the vibes. On recording is another story. You can make it as loud as you want. But when you're, you know, in a high volume performance, the vibes can only get so loud and it tend to get lost in things. And young musicians take up the vibraphone, take up instruments based on what they see on TV. And you don't see a vibraphone much. You see, you know, guitars, basses, drums, keyboards, singing, occasional saxophones, and so on. So a young, you know, teenager is not so likely to discover the vibraphone. I think that's another reason why we don't see it in popular music more. But thanks for the question.
I want to bring something up. We mentioned this tiny desk concert that you did at NPR, and I want to bring up, we're going to listen to this underneath us. It's called Remembering El Tano, which you did. This was a tribute to Astor Piazzolla, who you played a lot with. This is a beautiful piece, I thought, and I really recommend that listeners go to our website to see you play. And I want to ask you about that Burton grip in action.
Okay.
Because, so for people who haven't seen you play, so you've got two sticks in either hand, and I don't understand how you do it. It's just amazing to watch. It looks like magic. And I'm wondering if you could just talk about it.
Well, you know, you've got two mallets in each hand, and you open and close them. You have to change the spacing between them. And then you have to be able to hit each one individually or hit them both together. So those are the requirements for however you hold the mallets. And my technique for it isn't the only grip, as we call it. It happens to be currently the more common one that you find among the two or three alternatives out there. But it's not. It looks more dramatic than it is.
It looks really dramatic.
You know, if you could see the pianist's fingers enlarged to the size of, you know, my mallets on the vibraphone keyboard, they would also look kind of amazing. You know, with all the coordination of the different fingerings and so on. It's this that when we see these instruments, you know, we see the fingers twiddling a little bit down there. And, you look at a saxophone player, you see some fingers moving, but you don't really see the, you know, big sweeping physical movement going on.
But I understand that at one point people a long time ago when the vibraphone was first invented, they did play with four, but then the most players went to two sticks.
Yeah, the first mallet instruments were marimba, which had been around for centuries, and the xylophone, a related instrument, both with wooden keys. And the early players of the xylophone and marimba in the 19-teens and 20s, quite a few of them played fairly well with four mallets. But the vibraphone came along, and the early players of the vibraphone came to it from another instrument. So they wanted to learn it quickly and get functioning on it as quick as possible. And you can do that with two mallets, one in each hand.
Oh, I see.
Almost, you know, on the spot. You know, a piano player can learn to play the vibraphone in about 30 minutes.
Well, Gary Burton, it's been such a pleasure. I'm afraid our time is running out, but what a pleasure meeting you, hearing you talk, and and hearing your music, having an excuse to go into it deeply. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
That's Gary Burton. His memoir is entitled Learning to Listen, The Jazz Journey of Gary Burton. His new album featuring the new Gary Burton Quartet is Guided Tour. You can hear them performing tomorrow night at the Berklee Performance Center. There's more information at RadioBoston.org. And that's it for today. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.